Hello and welcome to Outside In. I'm John Burns, and today in the studio with me, I've got James Roddy, who is a professional photographer and wildlife guide based in the Highlands. Hi, James. How are you?
Hi, John. I'm good, thanks. You? Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. I'm great. Now, I understand one of the things that you've been specialising in, and you and I have actually been to your hide. You've got a hide that enables you to watch pine marten. How long ago did you start to set that up?
Well, I was actually hired as a guide about 4 or 5 years ago by another photographer who had set this hide up. And I've sort of kept it going since, I suppose. And it's been quite a long sort of haul. It takes quite a long time to get pine martens sort of used to people so that they'll come out in daylight. And yeah, so it's been a sort of few years working on it and working on the basis that I'd been given by James Moore, the other photographer.
Right.
It's brilliant. It's hard work, but pine martens are usually completely nocturnal. And during the summer, the females will come out and feed during daylight when they have kit, but they're usually very, very shy creatures. So I'm quite fortunate in that I've got a place where I do have pine martens that will regularly come in daylight in the summer, and only a few meters away. And there's only really a handful of places where that's possible in Scotland. Perhaps three or four places, I should think. And although there's plenty of places you can see them in darkness, it's quite unusual to see them in the middle of the day.
And how did you go about making sure that the pine martens would show up at the hide?
So initially, we had an individual animal starting to visit a few years ago, and between the other photographer and myself, we just had to put in a heck of a lot of hours just sat in the hide waiting, basically. So we would put out a small amount of food every day, so peanuts and honey, not a large amount. We don't want them to become reliant on it. Now, a small amount of food, and over the course of a long time, eventually they just sort of become used to human scent, human noises, the sound of shutter, noise off your camera, that sort of thing.
Right.
We're lucky in that we've got a female that the hide is in her territory. The males tend to be, they tend to move around far more, whereas the females will tend to stick in a smaller area. But it's just brilliant to be able to see these animals, because up until the last few years, they've almost been sort of mythically elusive creatures in Scotland. But thankfully, their numbers have increased a lot, thanks to, firstly, they're no longer persecuted in the numbers that they once were.
Right.
And secondly, there's been a concerted effort across Scotland to make sure there is enough habitat for them, and to actively encourage them to spread. They're part of a balanced ecosystem. So.
Yes. I mean, you're right, because I have lived in the Highlands now for, 35 years. And I'm thinking all that time, until I came to your hide, I'd only really glimpsed pine marten about twice. Usually just scuttling along by the side of the road. But when I saw them with you in your hide, they're a fascinating creature. And they're really, what struck me was just how colourful they are. They're beautiful sort of browns and sort of almost like a golden yellow bib. It was great to be able to get just so close to this fascinating, and it's a really wild creature, isn't it, too?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they're sort of top predators, really, as well. So they do have quite large territories. And apart from the Scottish wildcat, they're arguably the sort of rarest predator in the country. Up until recently, they were really quite rare indeed. So unfortunately, like so many of our predators, we almost hunted them to extinction, you know.
It's happened
to so many others. But no, it's good. They're a success story, along with ospreys and red kites and white-tailed eagles. It's brilliant, and you just have to see by the number of people that are now wanting to actually come up to Scotland to try and photograph them that, you know, there's a real interest, and it's good. You know, the perception around them has changed a lot, and there's now a sort of effort to try and get the numbers back up in Wales, and there's even some starting to be seen in the south of England now as well. So it's
That really is a success story. I mean, I think one of the things that's really important about Mike, I think it really is important that people have an opportunity to see these creatures, really, because, you know, we tend to, if we're trying to reintroduce an animal, trying to encourage its population to rise, then I think it's important people have a relationship with it. And I think maybe that your hide allows that.
I hope so. Yeah. I mean, it's certainly like when you hear the feedback from people and when they've seen their first pine marten, it's brilliant. You know, I've even had people in tears, you know, tears.
I'm not surprised. It is. It is an emotional thing to see, to be that close to a truly wild creature. I mean, that it meant a lot to me as well, you know.
Yeah. Well, it's good to hear, you know. It's brilliant.
And what about the rest of you? Obviously, you often take people out to into the Highland countryside, which I guess you know pretty well, to photograph wild animals. Is that mainly what you're involved in?
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, it's largely during the winter months because, you know, Scotland has so many sort of iconic species. People really want to see. So, you know, the main sort of attractions for people, I suppose, are the mountain hares, the red squirrels, of course, the red deer stags, things like that. And I suppose my sort of role is to take people out when they only have they're maybe on holiday for a few days or a week. My role is to sort of get people as responsibly and sort of safely, I suppose, as possible in close to the wildlife in a way that doesn't disturb the animals at all. And yes, I suppose it's just a good way, because if you have local knowledge, then you're going to have a much more sort of meaningful experience, I suppose, than if you go tramping around. And, you know, the Highlands have got vast areas of space, as you know, and actually, like, we don't have anywhere near as much wildlife as many other countries. So it can be remarkably hard to see some things that you might think actually are all over the place. But, you know, as you saw, we did a day out to see the mountain hares, as you were saying, you know, you've seen them many times in the past, but often you'll just, you know, you'll spook them or you'll see them running off in the distance. I suppose my role is sort of to get people in close in a way that doesn't disturb the wildlife, and just to, I suppose, if I can, increase awareness of the sort of issues surrounding our wildlife. Because, you know, the Highlands are a sort of battleground, really, aren't they, in terms of land ownership and how we, you know, how we behave around our wild spaces. And I find it remarkable how many people that come up from other bits of the UK or from abroad entirely unaware of it. And I suppose, you know, if it's not part of your day-to-day life, there's no reason you really would be. But I hope that, I hope people leave sometimes with a bit more appreciation of just how fragile, I suppose, a lot of these upland species, how fragile their lives are.
I think that's right. I mean, it was fascinating when you and I went into the Mauna Lea. I think it was in a very cold day in November, if I remember rightly.
Yeah, brilliant.
It was fun. But what was great about it, as you say, I'd seen mountain hares quite a bit in the past, but almost exclusively running away from me at great speed. You know, and what was great was you were able to take me not only to an area where there were lots of mountain hare, but you also knew the way of approaching them in such a way that they got, in a sense, they get confident with you. And you know, as you say, if you let them see you and you move very slowly towards them, they sort of get used to you. In fact, I think we got so close to a hare, I could almost have put my arm around it, I think. And it was actually half asleep by the time. It was dozing right in front of us, which was amazing. I would never have been able to do that if you hadn't shown me how to do that. So that was a fantastic experience, really.
Yeah, there's something very special, isn't there, about sort of gaining an animal's trust. And as you said, it was dozing, sort of.
Yes, that's right.
But, you know, you could never do that by just walking up to
no,
it. It just,
no.
It would, you'd never do that. And then, of course, if you spook the hares, then you're causing them to waste energy unnecessarily.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
But these upland species live on a knife edge, I suppose, and it's all about energy budgets. You know, if they don't need to move, then yeah. why would they? You know, so
absolutely
much the same with the ptarmigan up in the high hills. You actually see the place in which they live. It's so extreme, you know, during the winter months. So it's easy to understand why they spend a lot of their time just hunkered down, not moving. And
yes, it is. We often forget how a lot of these creatures sort of live on the edge. But one of the wonderful things that's happened, one of a really great step forward since you and I last November saw the hares, I'm very pleased to say that they've now become a protected species.
Yeah,
which I think is a fantastic step forward for Scotland and its wildlife.
It's just brilliant news. I mean, if you look at the studies carried out by various people, I think specifically Dr. Adam Watson, you know, the declines that have been shown in some areas have been staggering.
Yes.
And I mean, even just from my own personal experience of hill walking and various things in the Highlands, I mean, I certainly see far fewer of them in some areas than I did even a decade ago. And, you know, there's some areas that you've gone to where you'd have been tripping over them in the past, and there's just none left in some areas. So I think, you know, it's such a positive step. And if we can sort of pull that off, then it does give you hope for some other things. You know, it staggers me that it's still legal technically to shoot ptarmigan in Scotland. Like, it just, I find it astonishing when, again, they suffer local declines really badly, and those species, that the mountain hare and the ptarmigan, for example, they're sort of relic species from the last ice age. You know, they turn white during the winter, they live at high altitudes, and it's almost like life throws so much at them all the time without us getting involved and trying to kill them just for fun anyway, you know.
So
it's like all these things, it's complicated, it's not black and white, obviously.
No.
I hope that we're sort of increasingly moving towards a sort of Scotland where people would prefer to come up and watch and see wildlife rather than just kill it for fun, you know?
Yes, I do think that we are certainly beginning to see the seeds of change coming into the Highlands, because as you know, over the last 200 or 300 years, the Highlands have been dominated by big estates, which are essentially playgrounds for the rich, really, to indulge their sports of stalking stags and driven grouse shooting. And driven grouse shooting, I think, is both those things really contribute to the kind of devastation and exploitation that's been going on. And it was particularly, I think they're both pretty guilty in terms of the damage they've done. But driven grouse shooting, which is where men sit in what they call shooting butts, and they have beaters who drive red grouse towards them across like what was described as a grouse moor. And we don't really know how sort of, you know, the extent of grouse moors in Scotland, but it could be as much as 20% of the area. And the problem, as you know, is that causes massive problems to wildlife. But it does seem one of the issues, and one of the reasons that mountain hare was so much in trouble, was obviously because literally thousands of them were killed to protect the populations of grouse. So it's a great step forward. I don't know. I hope we can move on to the next step somehow. I'm not sure what that might be. I don't know if you'd have any thoughts on that.
Well, I mean, my thought is that if you look at the number of people that now come to Scotland in order to watch and appreciate wildlife and photograph wildlife,
it's
a hugely growing industry. Yes. And I mean, in the sort of few years that I've been working as a photographer and wildlife guide, the amount of demand has increased a huge amount. And actually, a lot of people are willing to pay a considerable amount of money for those sorts of experiences.
Yes.
And I think the point is that if we can, there is definitely a way, I think, in which some of the big estates can start moving towards an entirely different income model, as it were. So, you know, some of the estates now in the Cairngorms are starting to, they're starting to make large amounts of income from essentially ecotourism. So, for example, the Alvey estate down in Cairngorms near Aviemore is a lovely place. And that, you know, they now have a red squirrel hide. They have, they take people out on red deer photography days. They have a like a gorge scrambling, gorge walk sort of thing. And now they're getting a lot of money from people coming to sort of interact with the land in that way. Whereas in the past, it would have been farm almost exclusively, I suppose, I'm guessing, from, you know, more traditional things such as hunting and shooting. And and I wonder, I mean, it's not optimistic, I think, but the optimist in me does hope that maybe going into the future, more of these big estates are going to actually start moving towards that. Because I think people would be willing to sort of pay for certain experiences. And I know it's difficult because of land access issue in Scotland, because we do have the right to roam largely.
Yes.
But I think that, I don't know, I think that actually at this stage, with sort of small steps aren't quite enough, really. I think maybe we are going to need some more radical changes to happen. You know, there's just, we don't really have that much time left with some of these things, to be honest.
Well, you know? That's true. What sort of radical steps are you thinking of then? What do you think?
Well, as I said, so I think maybe in terms of some estates, how this would work politically, I don't know. But in some estates, potentially charging people for access to certain things and certain wildlife. Now, how that would work, I don't know. But I know, for example, where I take people to photograph the mountain hares, if that estate, for example, would charge even a small fee in order to just take people out to see them, we would all happily pay that, you know? And I think the people coming to see them would as well, because you can't really, the sort of value of those experiences are so, they stick with you, you know, and actually people would be willing. So I don't know. And I think, I don't know, if you look at the huge amount of Scotland that is still, it's frankly ecologically drained, a lot of it.
Yes,
still.
Yes, most of, and yes, the huge areas, yes.
And it's such a shame, because like, we have so much land that is, it's almost wild, as it were.
Yes,
but it's
just, that's right.
It's
that's
never
right.
near good enough.
That's right. Well, I mean, we've seen in places like Glenfeshy just what a difference it can make if you simply reduce the deer numbers. You know, the regrowth in Glenfeshy is amazing. And I mean, it is inevitably, I think, a political issue. You know, we've had huge estates owned by very wealthy men, really. And what they've left behind has been green deserts. And there is money, I think. I don't fully understand this, but there's a word for it. I can't remember what it's called now. But where you offset your carbon footprint by you know, preserving a peat bog or a wild forest somewhere else, and that may well be something that will bring income into the Highlands and make this financially possible.
Yeah, I mean, well, I mean, if you think, for example, so if you take some of our most iconic mountain areas, so take Glen Cove, for example.
Yes.
Can you imagine, so it's a magnificent place as it is, but can you imagine how great it would be if on your walk up onto the Anakegirk or the Three Sisters, if you got to walk through, you know, native deciduous forest, like you would do in Europe or America. You know, and there's some areas of Scotland. The one that always comes to mind with me is the Fannocks, actually, on the way to Ullapool. Mm-hmm. It's just so bare. There's just there's just nothing there. And like, there's no way that it couldn't be improved by having more trees, more growth, you know. Essentially, what we have is, from the glen level upwards, is it's almost sort of one ecosystem from the bottom of the glen almost to the top of the hills.
That's
apart from the very highest ones, where you have sort of subarctic tundra. But you know, you should be able to go through forests from the bottom that will slowly thin into a tree line, and then into sort of upper moorland, and then sort of semi-tundra as well. And the amount of biodiversity and just sheer variety of what you're looking at would be so much more interesting, you know. Yeah, and I mean, this is a completely separate issue, I suppose. But if you look at invertebrates, you know, bees and butterflies and wasps and hoverflies and things like that, their numbers are just plummeting. And the only way that's going to change is if we have more growth. It's as simple as that.
That's right. I mean, I think, and your wildlife guiding, certainly, I think, you know, can raise awareness of these issues, which is a very valuable thing in itself, you know. But yeah. I know that's one aspect of what you do, and you started out more or less as a photographer, I believe. But what other projects are you working on right now?
Well, as always, I'm getting out into the mountains whenever there's a decent weather window for landscape photography. So yeah, a fair amount of my work is just pure landscape photography that I sell to magazines and various sort of outlets. I suppose that's a side of my job that I mean I love that side of my job, because that's sort of the way that photographers would have made their living in the past. You know, you simply go out, you take photos that you would take anyway, and then you sell them. So I've always been into the hills and mountains for fun anyway, so I'm doing that. But just now, my main thing is photographing the summer snow in the mountains in Scotland.
Tell us about this, because some people listening won't be aware of how there can be snow in the summer in Scotland.
Yeah, so I mean, most years really in Scotland we still have patches of snow remaining most of the year round, or all year round really. Some years all of it melts, but most years there's still a few small areas left.
Yes, yes.
And there's a few of these spots, mainly in the Cairngorms and Ben Nevis as well, particularly. But a few of them will form sort of July, August sort of time. They'll form the most amazing tunnels and caves inside the snow patches. Mm-hmm. And I think people would be massively surprised at just the extent of these things. So just now in Scotland, you know, coming towards the end of July, some places still have in excess of 25 feet deep snow, you know, in Scotland. And if that happens to be sitting on top of an area that has drainage of water coming off the hill or a stream going underneath it, it'll tunnel out these amazing sort of sculpted tunnels and caves.
Oh, right. And
if you were to go into them, it would look, you'd think you were in Greenland or somewhere, you know, you think you were in a glacier. So there's a sort of, there's a few people that are really interested in this stuff, because it's sort of I suppose it's linked to climate change as well, but the way in which the snow patches survive every year, it's sort of it's a real matter of interest. But there aren't really many sort of photographers, particularly not professional photographers, there aren't many that actually have gone and sort of done this properly. And these snow tunnels, they're really quite hard to photograph well, because you're inside and it's fairly dark, and then coming from the entrance will be this bright sort of glare coming in. So usually people's pictures look, they always look kind of not that great. So what I've been doing is actually going out at dusk or dawn, and I've been lighting them extensively with flash guns from within and from outside. So I've produced a few images recently that I'm very excited about, and I think, I'm not sure, but I think it hasn't been done in quite the way I've done it before. I've actually employed sort of cave photography method to it.
That sounds really fascinating. It's not something you think you could possibly do in Scotland, is it really?
No, it's not. But I mean, the last one that I was in, it was on one of the Munros above Dalwhinnie, which usually I never go on those hills because I find them extremely boring and dull.
You mustn't say things like that.
there's a snow tunnel up on one of those Munros that I went to see the other day, and it was about 140 feet long, I think, this tunnel.
Wow.
You could easily stand up in it. You know, it was enormous. And there's something appealing about them, because they don't last very long. You know, they melt away quite quickly. So they're really quite fascinating. You have to be there exactly the right time.
I suppose that's right. I never thought about that. They're a very fleeting phenomenon, really, aren't they? And I suppose those areas are the areas where, if you know, climate change went the other way and it got a bit colder, those are the sort of places where Scotland's glaciers would begin to return, I'm guessing.
I would think so. Yeah. I mean, you look at Garth Corrie Moore and Ombraria in the Cairngorms, the snow has only melted there a handful of times over the last 100 years.
Yes.
Unfortunately, yes. Most of those times have been in the last sort of decade or so.
Yeah, absolutely.
But certainly, I mean, I don't think it would take much change in our climate, actually, to start getting the very, very early starts of sort of glacial activity starting. I think it would take a drop of temperature of maybe about 2 degrees average. It would be a very slow process, but who knows?
Who knows? We can always hope, can't we?
Yeah. So,
if people want to come out with you and to experience these places and to experience the snow caves that you can show them, or to photograph mountain hare and indeed the pine marten, how can they get in touch with you? What's the best way of doing that?
Just go to my website, which is jamesroddy.com, and there's all plenty of information on there. You just contact me directly, basically.
Right. Yeah. It sounds fascinating. I mean, I'm really keen to get along to your hide again at some point, and hopefully get reacquainted with the pine marten. That would be quite something, you know. Okay, Jay, it's been great talking to you. I wish you every success of what you're doing, and I hope things go good for you. You take care.
Yeah, thanks, John.
Okay, bye bye.